Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Sounds like the speakers, the microphone's working. Welcome to the session by Martin and Jennifer on ICAP. What does it mean for companies and what should actuaries be doing about it? I think you're all familiar with the format now. We'll have 20 minutes of presentation followed by 20 minutes of questions. For those who are asking questions, can I just ask you to please step up and use the microphone because the session will be recorded and that way we can capture your question. So given we're now a little bit past start time, I'll hand straight over.
Thanks very much, Anton, and welcome to the session. Plenty of room in the front row, but as long as you promise not to fall asleep. So, ICAP, what does it mean for companies and what should actuaries in particular be doing about it? So, we've got a split agenda. First of all, I'll be talking about ICAP in a general sense. What does it mean? How does it relate to the LAGIC? And then Martin will be talking particularly about what we can learn from what the ADIs have done, because as you probably all know, ADIs have had an ICAP for some time, particularly around what they've learned from stress testing and scenario testing, which is something that APRA's definitely been focusing on in the ICAP for ADIs. So moving straight into the agenda, because we've got a definite time constraint here, what is ICAP? Now, as you all know, APRA's been reviewing capital standards for life and general insurers for over a year now. Just before Christmas, they released some draft standards, which included for the first time more detail about a requirement for an ICAP summary statement and report. So ICAP stands for Internal Capital Adequacy Assessment Process, which is why we all say ICAP, because it's much quicker. And it's basically a holistic view of capital for a company. So it's not just about how much regulatory capital do we have and how do we manage it. It's about looking at the capital position for a company and upping the ante on governance. It's about saying capital is no longer the domain of an actuary sitting in a corner and calculating a number and telling everyone about it. It's an important part of managing the whole company. So it's not just about what's your regulatory capital, it's not just about what's your own economic capital, but it's about how do you manage capital in practice in your company and how do you use capital to enhance the experience of managing the company and managing the risk of the company. It's very much about the linkage between risk and capital. Now, I think as actuaries, we all instinctively think of risk and capital being linked, but they're not necessarily linked in every company. And part of what ICAP is about is to try and get that linkage working between risk and capital. I've always thought of this as saying that effectively capital is the price for risk. And I'll talk a bit more about that as we go forward in the presentation. But the key here is that capital, it's not just about a regulatory capital position. It's not just about how much capital you have. It's where do you get it from? How are you comfortable with your capital position? What kind of stress testing have you done? And most importantly, how have you embedded capital into the decision-making of your company? An example that some of my ADI colleagues told me about was that it's not just about you would think if you're pricing a new group risk scheme, just to use a very topical example, obviously you think about how much capital that's going to need. But if you're thinking about offshoring, that actually changes the risk of your company, changes your operational risk. That should have, if it's a material decision for the company, you should be thinking about the impact of that on your own view of risk and hence the capital of the company. May not be a difference, but it should be something that you're thinking about as part of the way you're managing the company. So in a broad sense, what ICAP is talking about is changing the risk management framework of the company. And this is really about bringing risk and capital closer together. So every insurer currently has a risk management framework, been required to for some time. They have a risk management strategy and a risk appetite. The first thing you need to do is have a look at their risk appetite and have a look and check that it has a really strong linkage with capital. Now, I'll talk a little bit more about what that means, but on the next slide. But it's really about saying capital is front and centre of the overarching framework of your risk appetite. Now, not every risk can be measured by capital. You know, strategic risk, it's pretty hard to say how much capital do I hold for a strategic risk. But a lot of risks can, and it's important to bring the whole thing together as part of your risk appetite. So the next part, that is looking at your risk management strategy, so not just your risk appetite, but all the things that come underneath that in terms of risk policies and saying, do they need to change as well to go with the risk management strategy change. So thinking about your ALM policy, thinking about your insurance risk policy, thinking about your op risk policy, all of those things are underneath effectively your risk appetite statement. Many of them you'll need to review and refresh to see, does that still make sense? And many of them you won't need to change, but I've certainly seen some insurers where, you know, effective, for example, your ALM policy has a lot of talk about capital adequacy and solvency and what you do there. That doesn't really make sense in the new framework, so you need to refresh that. And then the kind of overarching piece next is the ICAP, which includes the summary statement, which is about how do you manage capital in your business? What are the things that you have to do and how do you embed capital management to your business? Your business plan will need to be linked more strongly with both your ICAP and your capital, because effectively when we finished introducing the ICAP, your board will be writing a report to APRA which says, here's how we went for the last year and here's our plan for the next 3 years in terms of business planning, in terms of not just the best estimate of how much capital we're going to need, but what are the different scenarios that we need to look at that could stress the business and could mean that we need more capital, we'll need to find it from a particular place. So it's not just about saying what's our best estimate anymore, it's about looking at the stresses that could affect the business. So I think one of the things about this change risk management framework, I've kind of looked through at the high level, but if you think about all the things that are changing here, a lot of this is about saying it's about the board's view of capital, it's about management's view of capital, it's not just a view of the appointed actuary anymore. So it's very much saying it's the whole of business needs to think about capital as a key part of managing the business. Now, I think there's a spectrum here. Companies where capital has been the main constraint on their business and what they can do have always managed this way. But a large company which, you know, effectively distributes capital every year may not have capital as front and centre in the way in which they manage risk. What this is aimed at doing is saying we need to bring capital and risk management together and look at them together, as capital is effectively the price for risk. So I'm afraid this slide's not as clear as I'd like. It's a lesson for using white fonts on a light blue background. Linking capital with risk appetite. I think what you need to do here to link capital with risk appetite in detail is to look at the top level is very much about capital. It's not saying capital is something that goes alongside all of your different other risks. Capital is effectively at a top level. So there's a number of different ways of measuring capital. It's not just about regulatory capital. It's looking at economic capital. So what is the ultimate risk of you not meeting your policyholder obligations? Effectively measuring that is an economic capital view of the world. It's saying, how comfortable am I with the risk of not meeting my policyholder obligations? And that's the risk that you'd expect any board of a company to be least comfortable with. And then another way of looking at it is, how comfortable am I with the risk of not meeting my regulatory capital obligations? Now, given regulatory capital is already embedded in it a lot of capital to meet those policyholder obligations, you'd expect to be more comfortable with the idea of not meeting your regulatory capital than you are with not meeting your policyholder obligations. The way in which you measure those two things could be quite different. Most companies will give some credit for a DAC. Regulatory capital doesn't give that much credit for a DAC, for example. There's a number of different ways in which your own internal view of capital will be different from the regulatory capital view of capital. The third way, which is relevant for some companies, but probably not as many in this market, is the ratings agency view. So say I'm AA rated at the moment or A rated, how comfortable am I with the idea of losing that rating and what should I then hold as a capital position to allow for that? So most companies in an ADI and increasingly an insurance company would look at all of those three, and effectively one of them is going to be a binding constraint. Most cases it's probably going to be regulatory capital, but I think you learn a lot about your company by looking at all three, at least in a big picture sense, and saying, well, what do all these different things mean about how I manage my capital? Once you've done that, then you can look underneath that and say, well, what does that mean for my ALM risk appetite, my insurance risk appetite, and my operational risk appetite? What does my capital risk appetite mean for how much risk I'm willing to take in those different areas? So effectively, once you've done that, capital is your price for risk. Now, as I said before, capital can't be your price for every single risk, but one of the benefits of using an economic capital view of the world is it does give you a better way of measuring all of the risks, not just the risks that are easily measured in a regulatory capital framework. Operational risk is a classic example here. Your regulatory risk doesn't really tell you whether you've increased or reduced your operational risk. But if you've got an operational risk framework for capital which does increase or decrease as you've changed your operational risk. It gives you another way of looking at a business case. If you've got a business case that's looking at changing the way in which you administer a particular line of business, which will streamline things, you're not just reducing costs, you're also reducing operational risk. And that business case becomes easier to make if you've actually looked at a capital for, as a price for risk, not just at the P&L. So one of the things that I think you can get out of really putting capital front and centre in the way in which you manage your business is a much better way of managing risk holistically across the whole business. So that I think the way in which you can best do it is to say that you're looking at a profit after a capital charge. Other ways of doing it are looking at a return on capital. I think profit after capital charge is better because you've got a specific capital charge, but maximising your profit is still a benefit. So it gives you a better measure of how the business is going. So I guess the final point I wanted to touch on in my kind of overview of ICAAP is what is the role of the actuary? You might be wondering what the relevance of this slide is, the three levels of risk management. I think we'd all be familiar with the way in which many companies look at risk management is you've got the three lines of defence. Your first line is effectively the business itself, the business managing risk itself. The second line is your independent risk control and compliance team who take an overview of things but still very much very close to the business. And the third line is your internal or your external audit. So where does the actuarial team fit in there? And more particularly, where does the appointed actuary fit? And I think gradually that is changing with some of these changes. And it's a question that we in the insurance industry have to grapple with first because the ADIs effectively don't have that appointed actuary team or the actuarial team or the appointed actuary. So I guess my view is that it's really crucially important that you have actuaries in that first line of defence, really managing capital for the business. But I'm not sure that given that one of the things that's come out in the draft, not the draft standards yet, but the comment from APRA, is that the actuary is going to be commenting on capital in the FCR. I'm not sure how much the appointed actuary can be that first line of defence. I suspect it's more about an actuarial team, but the appointed actuary is almost moving towards the second or even third line of defence, the more in which they're commenting on what the business is doing. So it's very much the business taking responsibility for capital and the appointed actuary advising the business on how well they think the business is doing. So I think there is a huge need for our profession to really help companies to do all of this work. There's a huge amount of work, there's a huge amount of thinking in terms of embedding capital management into the business, as well as in calculating things, but it's also in how you manage things. But I think it's going to be actuaries all along those different three lines of defence, not necessarily the appointed actuary in that first line, in the way in which we've historically been. So that's a very high-level look at ICAAP, where I see the role of actuaries, and what are the kinds of things that I think people have to change in their governance framework. I'm now going to hand over to Martin, who's going to talk about the ADI experiences and what we can learn from it in the insurance side.
Thanks, Jennifer. I'm going to provide some insights into how ADIs have implemented the ICAAP rules that apply to them. This slide is a graphical representation of the ICAAP process adopted by many ADIs. You'll notice that this process is similar to the risk management processes that most life insurers would already have. However, in our experience, the level of sophistication adopted by ADIs in performing steps 2, 4, and 6 is greater than what we see life insurers adopt. Unfortunately, I've only got 8 minutes left now to provide you with some insights into how ADIs perform these steps. So I'm going to limit my discussion to steps 2 and 6. A key aspect, as Jennifer mentioned, of the ICAAP is to ensure that the level of capital that you're determining is appropriate and is consistent with the risks that you're bearing. This diagram here is a demonstration of this process. So basically what ADIs do at the moment or historically is they determine economic capital and then add buffer reserves on top. You'll notice that this process is similar to the target surplus calculations that life insurers undertake. However, in our experience, there are some differences. For example, ADIs use stress testing to validate that the level of capital is appropriate. So that's a key difference. This slide is my representation of how APRA's views regarding the capital management of ADIs has changed over the last 5 years. So the ICAP rules that apply to ADIs were introduced 5 years ago when the GFC was first starting. As the severity of the GFC became more evident, APRA's focus on stress testing increased. There's several reasons why this occurred, but one of them was that APRA was concerned that the level of capital that was being determined for some risks and products was insufficient. As APRA and regulators around the world increased their focus on stress testing, they came to the view that the level of stress testing, the severity of the stress tests, I should say, weren't sufficient enough, and they were inconsistent with the losses that were occurring during the GFC. This led to a focus on reverse stress testing. Reverse stress testing is identifying events that are going to lead to an ADI failing. However, the current focus of APRA, so these are all the events that have been occurring, but the current focus of APRA is on living wills. Living wills refers to two separate concepts. The first one is recovery planning and the second is resolution planning. Recovery planning refers to what actions an ADI will take so that they will survive an event that threatens their solvency, while resolution planning refers to what events an ADI will take in the event that they fail so that they can be wound up efficiently and effectively. I have to skip through all these slides. Stress testing. So APRA's view is that stress testing should play an important role within an ADI, and it has an important role to play in many different areas. This slide highlights those different areas. As you can see, in APRA's view, ICAP has an important role to play. Stress testing has an important role to play in the ICAP and in setting risk appetite. It also has an important role to play in all these other areas as well. So how do you use stress testing to set your risk appetite statement? Well, you can use stress testing to set your risk limits and also your risk tolerances. This diagram is a graphical representation of how you can use stress testing to set your risk limits. The first step of the process is you need to develop a scenario that's consistent with the risk that you want to set a limit for. Then the next step of the process involves determining the loss that's going to occur for that scenario and the likelihood of that scenario occurring. Then you use this information and information about the business strategy and the current capital position of the ADI, and then what you do is then you consider the implications of that scenario and you benchmark those implications against the risk appetite statement. So basically what you want to do is you want to investigate the implications of the scenario, compare that to your risk appetite statement, and then use that information to determine an appropriate risk limit. So I've got an example on how to do that, a demonstration. So this is my example insurer. It only writes group insurance. I won't go through all the different statistics now. But a key risk for this group insurer is mispricing risk. So my scenario is that I've got two schemes here, but I changed this so basically mispriced one scheme by 20%. So for this insurer, that would generate a loss of $10 million. So for this insurer, the implication of this scenario is that profitability would be halved by 50%, and that reduced profitability would last for 3 years due to the rate guarantee. The implication also is that the ability for the insurer to grow would be limited because of the reduced profitability. Depending on the business strategy and the risk appetite of the insurer, different risk limits would be appropriate. I've assumed an exposure limit of $50 million is appropriate for this insurer. This exposure limit is based on it's basically annual premium net of reinsurance. So my exposure limit is annual premium net of reinsurance of $50 million. And I've assumed that this is consistent with the growth strategy, access to capital and risk appetite of that insurer. So I'm considering all those factors when I've determined that risk limit. The last topic I just wanted to talk about in a little bit more detail is reverse stress testing. So traditional stress testing involves starting with a scenario and then determining the loss, while reverse stress testing starts with the loss, and then you determine a scenario that's consistent with that loss. So how do you go about determining that scenario? Most ADIs adopt a circular process. So the first step involves identifying the key risks that are going to lead to the ADI failing. The next step of the process then involves identifying events that could cause that risk to crystallise. The third step then involves investigating the implications of that scenario, of that event. And then the fourth step involves analysing the impact of that implication. The last step of the process then involves you've analysed the impact. That impact will then cause secondary events to occur. So the last part of the process then involves analysing the implications and impacts of that secondary event. This diagram here summarises that process. For my example insurer I had before, I've got a reverse stress test scenario that's based on that insurer. A key risk for this insurer is exposure to the economy. So my scenario is the following. We've got a recession in China caused by a reduction in global growth that leads to a major recession in Australia. The implication of this scenario is that government bond rates drop, credit spreads increase, and the unemployment rate rises. Obviously, the reduction in the government bond rate and the increase in credit spreads would lead to asset liability mismatch losses, while the increase in the unemployment rate would lead to TPD and disability claims experience deteriorating. These losses may also result in a reduction in the credit rating of the insurer and an inability to raise additional capital. The combined impact of the emerging losses and the inability to raise capital might then lead to concerns about the solvency of the insurer, and then this may result in the profitable group schemes leaving the insurer. The combined impact of all of these events leading to the insurer defaulting essentially or becoming insolvent. So this is like a high-level summary of the reverse stress test scenario. In practice, the reverse stress test scenario adopted by ADIs is more complex and allows for management actions and so forth. So I'll hand back to Jennifer.
Thanks. Gone too far. So finally, we just wanted to summarise the whole view of ICAAP from our perspective. The actuarial profession effectively is the intersection of the finance and the risk and the treasury teams. In banks, there is often a team that is in that intersection, which may or may not include actuaries. In our view, the actuarial profession is effectively in that position for insurance companies, and that makes them very key in the management of capital. So the actuary has the ideal skill set to advise the business on capital management. And in our view, the ADI experience shows that stress testing is an excellent part of the toolkit to help insurers manage the capital process. Economic capital is one part, stress testing is another part, and all of those together facilitate better risk management and business strategic thinking. Now, to kick off the discussion, I wanted to pose a couple of questions to the floor just to make sure we had a good chance to use the time that Martin and I have made available by skipping over slides. And I guess a couple of questions I wanted to ask were, what does everyone think the role of actuaries and the appointed actuary is in this process? And also the relative roles of stress testing, economic capital management and the regulatory capital. You know, what are the most important things for the profession to concentrate on as we go into this process? So I guess I'll hand over to the floor.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks, Martin. We've still got a few minutes left, so there is time for questions or responding to Jennifer's questions. I skipped over introducing our two presenters at the start because I was worried we may run out of time. So I'll give a very brief welcome to Jennifer Lang, who's recently joined KPMG as a senior partner in the actuarial team, previously being chief actuary at CommInsure. And I'm sure you all know Jennifer and probably heard her speak on capital topics previously. Martin Pono is a partner at KPMG Actuarial with 14 years' experience and has recently been assisting companies implementing ICAP and has also been working closely with KPMG's banking colleagues. So that's where he gets his ADI experience from. So as I said, over to you. Any questions? Please step up to the microphone.
Bruce Vincent, so thanks for the presentation. We'll probably get the whole presentation and go through in detail, but it is good to actually have a chance to have some sort of discussion. So I'm actually very interested in what the role of the appointed actuary will be, and of course all actuaries. I did note in the APRA's response to the submissions that it was in section 3.2 that there was a statement there that they expected even greater interaction between the appointed actuary and the board. I think I also noted that the LPS 320 will be changed. The LPS 320, amongst other things, sets out when the appointed actuary gives advice on products. And so I'm sort of wondering whether the nature of the process will actually step up in the same way that product advice has, and that's for good reason. And I do feel that whilst the FCR has been mentioned as an area of commentary, in fact, the involvement will be ongoing and progressive, not just at the end of the process. So I guess I'm wondering whether this is going to be quite an intensive process, a bit like the product advice, a lot of cohesion in terms of how things work through, but at the end you get a proposal and you get advice, a bit like the product area. So I'm just interested in what other people think about how that's going to work.
I guess I've kind of said what I think may happen, but I think the key thing is that I think all companies will need actuarial skill sets, but I think we need to think through as a profession what is the best way in which those skill sets are used to advise companies. Is it all via the appointed actuary, or is it actually the appointed actuary and other actuaries working in different areas the way we effectively do in pricing these days? So pricing often is done by somebody else with a commentary from the appointed actuary. Is that where we're going to end up on capital?
Hello, it's Rob Daly. Again, great presentation. Thanks. Like Bruce, I'll look through the slides later on. Again, it's really just another comment. And the sense I've got is that the appointed actuary, as Bruce says, will become perhaps a board advisor and more engaged with the board. But that then means who's going to discuss things with the executive. And I actually suspect there might be different engagement in the first line of defence with the executive business. And maybe, not sure what that means for actuaries, but I agree with Jennifer that actuaries will be there in both parts of the process, but there might be a slight separation of the appointed actuary from the day-to-day running of the business, which on balance I'm probably not in favour of, but I suspect that's the way it's going to go.
Yeah, I guess I should say I'm not in favour of that either, because I think the business gets a lot of benefit from having the appointed actuary very, very involved on a day-to-day basis and really understanding the holisticness of all of the strategic issues facing. And the more you're commenting and the less you're actually involved, the less you're kind of adding that detailed day-to-day view. But I guess it seems to me that that's the direction that we're heading.
Any other questions? I did have one question. I mean, is it? Do you see this really as a big change for companies, or is it more a relatively small evolutionary step from current practices with capital management plans and so on? Or if it is a big step, do you see it as a compliance exercise to tick the boxes in the new world, or is it something that companies are really going to embrace and change the way they manage themselves?
I guess my view is that in some ways it shouldn't be a big change, but the big change is it's really elevating the conversation about capital to the board It's not just... It's very much asking the board to take a much higher degree of responsibility, and particularly that requirement for the board to write... I mean, obviously the board's not going to actually write it, but to be this... to be sending a report to APRA on an annual basis. There's really only one document that the board sends to APRA at the moment, or to anyone, which is the accounts. So we're kind of doubling that. And that's quite a big change, I think, in a board responsibility sense. And there's a whole lot of things that flow from that. And I think it depends in a company sense how much capital has already been front and centre, and how you manage the business, how big a change it is from there. But you know, not every company has capital front and centre. Profit has a major role to play in many companies, far more than capital. And it's moving capital to be equal with profit, effectively.
I'd also say that the stress testing is an area where life insurers just... The level of sophistication that life insurers adopt around stress testing isn't what you see in the ADI space, and that's where you're going to see some improvements. So I don't know too many life insurers that do reverse stress test scenarios and so forth, so I think that's an area where people need to beef it up. So I suppose the point I was making before was that the stress testing, the reverse stress testing and the living wills, they've all had implications for the ICAAP processes that ADIs have followed. So what you've seen is ADIs implemented the ICAAP in 2007, and then as APRA's increased their focus on stress testing and reverse stress testing and the living wills, those developments are then fed back into the ICAAP. And what we expect to see is that those developments in the stress testing, reverse stress testing, and to some degree the living wills, which is all about capital planning, those feeding into the ICAAPs that life insurers adopt.
Tom Cheran from Merrill Lynch. I'm just interested in some of the sort of parallels between the banking and the insurance industry in pursuing the ICAAP passionately. And as a skeptic, now I find that companies are looking to save capital and probably push up their ROEs with the ICAAPs. And what's your view as one of the persons being the intermediary in this process, some of the challenges between companies trying to push for a higher ROE by using ICAAP model versus actual value from it and risk management benefits?
My understanding is that when the ICAAP first came out, ADIs saw that as an opportunity to convince APRA that they needed to hold less capital. I think the events during the GFC changed their minds about that. So I think originally that was what it was about, but it changed over time.
And I guess I would say that there's probably less scope for that on at least the life insurance side, where we're not really going to an internal model approach compared with what there was in the ADIs, where the big ADIs were basically building their own internal models with the intent of savings of capital. That said, I don't think that anybody's going into this with the idea of just adding more capital for the sake of it, but I don't think there's a big expectation that people are going to save capital by doing the work that they're doing at the moment.
Hi, Heather Navid. Just sort of wondering about when the ICAAP was brought in for the ADIs, the sort of engagement that happened with APRA, particularly around the frontline supervisory teams as the ICAAP was being developed, because I guess the PPGs are not coming out until September, and if we want to get kind of consistency across the frontline supervisory teams, it feels like we want to really take them on the journey, so I'm interested to know.
Yeah, that's a very good question. When I speak to our banking colleagues, I ask them, well, what guidance to ADIs did APRA give the ADIs? And the feedback that I got was the following, that originally APRA did provide some guidance on what to do, but then they revoked it because they were concerned that the ICAAP was just becoming a process, a tick-a-box process that APRA had outlined, this is what you need to do, and ADIs were just going along and ticking it off and they weren't actually developing and thinking about the process. So APRA removed that guidance and then basically said to the ADIs, you go away and work out what you should be doing and come back to us. And then that's why you've seen this evolution in what people are doing with their ICAPs, because they've done something, APRA's then looked at it, looked at what everyone else is doing, and then said, well, you need to improve here and here and here. So I'm not very confident that you're going to get a lot more guidance when it comes out in the next couple of months, and I think APRA's mentioned that in some forums as well.
Sorry, Trang Duncanson. I was just wondering, with the bank experience, with the ICAP process, do you know with banks what really drives the supervisory adjustment? Is it the experience with the ICAP process or the lack of?
I'll let you go with that one.
I don't think I'm close enough to what APRA's thinking is on the supervisory adjustments to know exactly what drives it. But I know one of the comments we've seen from the UK, which is similar, is that some of it is about general risk management, how good is an entity's risk management, but some of it is also how good is your particular process around ICAP. So how seriously are you taking it, and how much are you really using capital in practice to manage the business? I think it's reading the tea leaves. The actual supervisory adjustment is a fairly confidential item held quite closely within the senior levels of each bank. So I don't think you'd be able to tell exactly what drives each one.
Robert Soyser, bringing it back to the role of the actuary, we recently had an insight session where the discussion was about the role of the actuary, and the general consensus was it was an opportunity. Seeing how you've structured, sort of set this out, first line, second line of defence, do you see there's a potential conflict of interest in that the actuary is the commons and not actually do, and therefore anybody that reports to him could lead to that conflict?
I guess that's why I see us moving as an appointed actuary to the third line of defence, because of that conflict. Because I think you absolutely need the actuarial skill set to do all of this. But the appointed actuary, as opposed to all of the actuaries who might assist the company, if they're going to be required to comment on something, it makes it very hard for them to do it as well. It's similar to the risk management comment in the FCR. It makes it very hard for an appointed actuary to be a CRO, even though, in my view, an appointed actuary would make an excellent CRO because they really understand the risks of the business. It's very hard to do that without really addressing those conflicts in a very serious way. And I think this is driving us down that same path for capital.
I think we're almost out of time. We do have time for probably one more question.
Just want to make an observation. So I think the three pieces of change, picking up on Anton's question before, the three big pieces are the governance piece, so the board is going to own capital management rather than something that the actuaries do. Scenario testing is a second big piece, and the third one is to be able to demonstrate to APRA that you are actually embedding it into your business.
Okay. Last chance? No. Okay, so I'd like to thank Jennifer and Martin for their presentation.